You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, found online at kpfa.org. I'm Sasha Lilly. Our modern era is an era of fear. Whether in times of war or peace, we've come to expect those in power to use fear to rally support for themselves, sometimes with diminishing effect. But as the riots that took place across the UK last week remind us, political fear runs both ways. The fears that the people have of those in power is matched and intertwined with the fear elites have of those over whom they rule. The ways that fear has been conceived and deployed politically in the modern era is the subject of an enduring work by political scientist Corey Robin. Fear, the History of a Political Idea, published in 2004 by Oxford University Press, examines the intellectual trajectory of fear in its myriad forms, as an elite tool to unify a stratified society, as a means of social control, and as the shadowy lurking fear of the downtrodden. Robin teaches at Brooklyn College and the CUNY Graduate Center, and his forthcoming book out this autumn is The Reactionary Mind. I recently had the chance to speak with him, and I began by asking him how political fear differs from other kinds of fear.
Well, political fear has a very public character that differentiates it from individual fear. All of us have our own individual fears that really say very little about the state of public life. I have a fear of heights, for example. That there's no political source to that fear, and there's no political consequence to that fear. And I think all of us could go through a whole inventory of our own personal fears that neither, as I say, arise from the public realm, nor do they have any consequences for the public realm. Political fear is something whose origins lie in the political realm. So there's any one of a number of examples one could give. The fear that blacks had in Jim Crow America of their white overlords, those were not private personal fears. I mean, they certainly had personal consequences, and they were experienced at the personal level. But they arose from the political realm, and they had tremendous consequences for the political realm. It underwrote a whole system of entrenched racial hierarchy and white supremacy. And so that's what I think really distinguishes personal fear from political fear. And what I'm really interested in the book is political fear and how to think about that. And I have a set of arguments about that that we can get into in this interview.
And listeners may assume that when we're talking about political fear, we're simply thinking about that kind of instrumentalist use of fear by elites to control populations. But as you illustrate in your book, fear in the elite mind can take a number of different forms. And in a contemporary setting, one of the things that has flourished, and I guess in particular flourished after September 11th, was this notion amongst liberals that political fear, or a response to political fear rather, could be in many ways an answer to a sort of atomized society, something that could pull us all together. Can you explain that for us?
Yeah, it's actually a very old story. It goes back to the foundations of modern thought. But I think the simple argument for liberals goes something like this, and this is a certain type of liberal, I should say, but it goes like this, which is, we live in a world, the human condition is such that we live in a world where we all have permanent, intractable disagreements about what is right and wrong, what is good and right, good and bad, good and evil, just and unjust. And for the liberal, there's no way to actually resolve those differences. That's just what it means to be human, basically, or at least what it means to be modern. We can't go back to the medieval Catholic worldview or the ancient Greek Aristotelian view, in which you could say, well, this is what it means to be human, and therefore this is what it is to be good. That's the world we live in, says the liberal. And in such a world like that, we have to find, however, some source of commonality. And one source of commonality that we can find is the fact that fear is the worst of all possible experiences. We may not know what good is, but we certainly know what the bad is. And in fact, we may not know the summum bonum, the highest good, but we know what is the worst evil, the summum malum. And that worst evil is fear and the practices of cruelty that inspire it. So, for instance, genocide, right? You can say you believe in God, you don't believe in God. You can say you believe in democracy or you believe in a different system, but nobody could credibly argue that genocide is a good thing. This is the argument that, a lot of liberals made, particularly in the 80s and the 90s. And from that agreement about what is the worst thing that's, you know, the worst bad, as it were, we can generate a whole society, a whole collective form of existence where we can live together and cooperate. So that's one big part of that argument. And the other is the one that you noted in your question, which is, in addition to being divided in terms of our moral principles, we're also sociologically divided, right? There was a big book that was written in the late 90s that got a lot of attention called Bowling Alone by Robert Putnam. And it's, again, it's an old story, but it's basically that we all live these very individualized, atomized existences, what David Riesman called the lonely crowd in the 50s, and that we have no way to come together. And what fear, and by fear in this case I mean the fear of an enemy, the fear of another, the fear of Al-Qaeda, the fear of bin Laden, that kind of thing. What that kind of fear can do is to create a sense of commonality and a sense of shared destiny in which we are willing to come together and make sacrifices. And what was so astonishing to me was, and given the argument of my book and the intellectual history that I've, you know, that I had engaged in, I shouldn't have been surprised by this, but I really actually was surprised, was how many liberals in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, far from condemning the atrocities, I mean, they certainly did that, but there was a way in which they welcomed them as well. And this is people like George Packer in The New Yorker. Even people like Frank Rich early on, you know, said this is a way to really get us out of the kind of pedestrian existence we were living in the Clinton, you know, the go-go 90s. And so that was the second part of the argument. So it's a two-pronged argument. One is about moral disagreement, and from that we can generate agreement. And the other is, out of the lonely crowd, we can become a kind of robust army of collective will.
And perhaps it will become more apparent as this conversation continues and we talk about the history of modern political fear. But let me just simply ask you, what's so wrong about liberals thinking that an opposition to these horrors and having fear be the glue, what's so wrong with that as being a great unifier? What are the political consequences of that?
Well, I think, I mean, and I probably, I don't even know if I knew this at the time that I was writing the book, but it's become so apparent since then, is it actually doesn't work. And the reason why it doesn't work is as follows, and this is where the history of political thought does become very important. If you look at ancient and medieval accounts of fear, they situated the experience of fear, the psychological experience of fear, within a broader moral framework. I mean, Aristotle, I think, is the clearest statement about this. Aristotle says that a courageous man, I mean, he talks about this in a couple of different ways, but one of the ways he talks about it is to say that a courageous man is somebody who fears the right things in the right way and at the right time. And in other words, and those categories of rightness, the way we decide what is right, is based upon a discussion of what is the human good? What does it mean to be human? What's the proper way to be human? So a courageous person, and he had a particular idea of what that meant, right? A courageous man should not fear poverty. Should not fear, or I can't remember, maybe should fear poverty, but shouldn't fear death on the battlefield, right? So there's a whole set of moral frameworks, and from those moral frameworks, you will learn to fear the right things in the right way at the right time. And I think in a way he's right about that. The problem with liberalism is it wants to sidestep that moral framework. It wants to say, look, there is a universal experience of fear. All of us are fearful, let's say, of violent death, right? We're all fearful of violent death. This is sort of one version of Thomas Hobbes' argument. So we're all scared of violent death. Well, the fact of the matter is we know that that's not true, right? In some situations, we're certainly scared of violent death. In others, we know that many people are willing to brave that for the sake of some other value that matters to them. So I think that's the basic problem, is that you're trying to smuggle a moral agreement in the absence of a moral agreement. In other words, liberalism isn't even true to its own deepest insights, and it's trying to build a foundation on something that you can't build. And as you know, as we saw in the aftermath of 9/11, that unity that we were supposed to have experienced in the face of Al-Qaeda evaporated extraordinarily quickly. I mean, I would say that, and you could see glimmers of it very early on, but you know, it really, I would say going into that 2004 election, that was the last gasp of that unity. You can't build a society upon fear. It just doesn't work.
You just mentioned the very important English thinker Thomas Hobbes, who really, in many ways, reshaped the notion of fear in the modern era. And while I guess you would see yourself on the opposite side of the divide from Hobbes, you also argue there's a lot to be learned from him. And he wrote his ideas around fear coming out of the English Revolution of the 1600s, which really upended society. And as an aside, the question of revolution and counter-revolution seems to be really important, actually, for the development of this notion of political fear. But perhaps you could start by explaining for us what Thomas Hobbes did with this notion of fear, and what can be actually learned from him.
Okay. I mean, I think there's a couple of things, and where I would begin is something I've already suggested, which is that Thomas Hobbes is really the one of the first great thinkers. There are a couple around him that are lesser known, except among academics. But he's really the first great thinker to wrestle with this problem of what we would call moral pluralism. That is to say, that we live in a fallen world where all of us has our definition of good and evil, right and wrong. And Hobbes said, you know, that basically there's no real way out of that. That is the world. There is no way of resolving that that disagreement, except, and here's the innovation of his argument, was to say that basically, no matter how you define good and bad, you know, you think the pursuit of economic well-being is the highest good for you. I think the pursuit of literary excellence is the highest pursuit for me. You know, whatever that may be, however we define our own good, and he was very clear that we define our own good as we see it, you have to be alive in order to pursue that good, right? You cannot pursue economic well-being if you're dead. I can't pursue literary excellence if I'm dead. We have to be alive. Life is the condition, in other words, for the pursuit of the good, however we see we see it. And therefore, we have to have the fear of death should be the sort of the centerpiece of that existence. So that's the first that's the first part of the argument. The second, though, was that, you know, he wrote at the time of the English Revolution, which was an extraordinarily violent, cataclysmic event for Britain. I've seen figures to suggest that the casualty rates between both from the war itself and the diseases that ensued were something on the order of what the First World War was like, proportionately. And what Hobbes was so taken by, you might say, in a negative way, was the willingness of ordinary men and women to die. To both, not just to kill, but to be killed for the sake of how they defined the good. So, and this is something that a lot of interpreters get wrong when they look at Hobbes, because they say, well, Hobbes basically believes all of us are afraid of death, and it's a natural fear. Not so. He didn't think, he thought that was the problem, was that we were not sufficiently afraid of death. So what he did then, in kind of his masterwork, Leviathan, was to construct a whole vision of how you could actually go about teaching people to be afraid of death. And he has a whole elaborate vision, which, you know, we don't need to get into, but it involves what Lenin called the transmission belts of civil society, basically, which is that, you know, from the king to the universities, who would train preachers, who would then go out into the countryside and educate gentlemen and the ordinary, ordinary people, that they had to understand that they ought to be afraid of death, and that if they were going to live, they had to submit to the to an absolute sovereign, the absolute power of the monarch, and that was the and this is the part that a lot of people don't get, that, you know, Hobbes is depicted as this terrible authoritarian, this totalitarian tyrant, but what his argument was that this is the condition of your own flourishing, right? If you want to, again, pursue your own economic well-being, and I pursue my literary excellence, there has to be peace. I have to be secure. And the only way you can get real security is by essentially consenting absolutely to the sovereign power of the monarch. And so there's what's so striking about Hobbes, to my mind, is not the authoritarianism of the argument, that's obvious. It's the way in which he envisions your own individual emancipation and flourishing to be premised upon this absolute form of submission to absolute authoritarian rule. And as I suggest toward the end of that discussion, you know, there's a way in which he's onto something there. I mean, I disagree with the vision, but if you look at some of the tyrants that have existed around the world, I looked in particular at some of the accounts of Pinochet's Chile in the 70s and 80s. You know, a lot of the testimony from people who cooperated and consented was that, you know, it was, you got a better life, basically, in one way or another. And I think, you know, when we talk about authoritarian regimes, oftentimes we imagine these terror-stricken people who are completely terrorized and get nothing from their terror. But that, it seems to me, is very simplistic. That people who accede to their own fear usually get something for it. And that's what Hobbes understood, is that if you can make people see that they will get something by cooperating and acceding to their fear, you will have developed an extraordinarily powerful regime.
Right. So, in fact, it's not just a top-down theory, but a bottom-up as well.
Very much.
The program is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, found online at kpfa.org. I'm Sasha Lilly, and my guest is Corey Robin. He's the author of Fear, and he teaches political science at Brooklyn College and the CUNY Graduate Center. So I'm afraid, for the purposes of time, I'm going to be compressing a fair amount of intellectual history in this, but you focus on two other figures beyond Hobbes who shaped our notion, or at least the modern notion, of political fear. One is Baron Montesquieu, who wrote what he did in the context of the tyranny of Louis XIV, and then Tocqueville, who responded to a change climate in France following the French Revolution, which of course ousted and decapitated Louis XVI. So tell us how these two thinkers developed a notion of political fear, which has real ramifications down to our day in terms of how, as you said earlier, liberals see political fear.
Well, I think Montesquieu, there was really two innovations, and again, you can see them very clearly by comparing his account of despotic terror with Hobbes's account of what I call rational and moral fear. Montesquieu, basically, when describing the experience of fear, created what I think of as a kind of cartoonish, yet very influential, account of terror. This is the fear and trembling, where you're so paralyzed with fright by a bloodthirsty, ravenous, sadistic tyrant, and, you know, a real Caligula-type figure, that you are essentially divested of all reason. And you're reduced to the state of a kind of a trembling animal, a kind of Pavlovian dog, where you will do whatever you are told without even thinking. You become a pure instrument of another's will, basically. And that the way that that's created is not through this elaborate architecture that Hobbes had talked about, right, where you understand that the condition of your goodness, of your the pursuit of your good, is that you submit to the tyrant. All that kind of stuff is just completely out the window. There is no reason, there is no argument, there is no morality. It's just pure violence. It's the pure violence of a sadistic tyrant whose rule Montesquieu compares to the kind of the physics you see when a pool cue hits a billiard ball, right? That's the kind of power he's talking about, the pure physics of violent power. So that was the first thing, was that he transformed, he stripped fear of all the elaborate architecture that Hobbes had provided for it, and reduced it to the experience of, you know, pure raw violence, which again was inconceivable to Hobbes. For a couple of reasons. One, you know, he thought, well, witnessing these people in the Civil War, they weren't scared of violence whatsoever. They were willing to die. And so it was just sort of inconceivable to Hobbes. And also what was inconceivable to Hobbes, and I think this comes to the second innovation of Montesquieu, was that any one figure could ever wield that kind of monopoly of violence. For Hobbes, it was always, you know, you could say the army's going to force the people, but what's going to coerce the army? You know, so you need some kind of willing cooperation if you're going to even generate the kinds of violence or the instruments of violence that Montesquieu imagined. Well, Montesquieu, you know, there is no apparatus like that. For him, it's really this single-minded despot who has accomplices, but whose accomplices are as terrorized as the population are. And it's a very puzzling picture because, of course, well, how did that happen? You know, who is this despot? Is he some kind of strong man who beats them up himself? It's very unclear. So I'd say those are the innovations, is transforming the actual individual experience of fear by stripping it of all morality and emotion on the one hand, and then the political sociology of fear gets transformed, you know, whereas with Hobbes you have this elaborate set of institutions and moral instruction. In Montesquieu, it's just this despot with a monopoly over the means of violence, just wielding them indiscriminately. So that was the big innovation of Montesquieu's. Tocqueville, as you pointed out, comes after the French Revolution and the execution of Louis XVI. This is, you know, good. He's writing in the 1830s, so a good 200 years after Hobbes, almost 100 years after Montesquieu. And it's a very different world that he's describing, particularly when he comes to the United States. And for all the differences between Hobbes and Montesquieu, there was ultimately a notion that fear, whether it was understood as rational fear or terror, served the interests, or was created by, was in a top-down way, even though Hobbes also understood there was a bottom-up dimension as well, but that bottom-up for Hobbes had to be engineered from the top as well. Tocqueville doesn't understand that. He really believes in a democracy. Everything happens from the bottom up. There are no more elites. There are no more real institutions that govern the mass. Everything wells up from the bottom. So the mass is really governing both itself, and the mass is governing the top. And you can, you know, understand from his perspective. He was from a very big, prominent aristocratic family from Normandy. He had lost a lot of his relatives in the Reign of Terror. So, you know, to his mind, the notion that the masses could be governing and terrorizing the elite was not inconceivable. So that was the first thing. He turned the world upside down, or at least the way we think about the world. And then the second thing is that, you know, if Hobbes talks about rational fear and Montesquieu talks about despotic terror, what Tocqueville really talks about is mass anxiety. This is not a fear of violence. It's not a fear of punishment. It's much more the kind of anxiety that we were talking about earliness of the lonely crowd. That is, people who live in isolated existences and feel without any kind of sense of security or sense of common belief system. And in that existence, they feel a tremendous amount of anxiety. And again, there's a, you know, if you read any 1950s social thought, you see very similar accounts. And that mass anxiety produces the desire for a strong man, right? So mass anxiety generates this desire for a tyrant who will then restore everybody to a sense of commonality, common purpose. So whereas for Hobbes and Montesquieu, it's coercion and repression in part that create fear, Tocqueville flips that around and says, no, it's fear, now understood as anxiety, that creates coercion and repression. And that had tremendous impact on how 20th century thinkers understood things like totalitarianism and so on and so forth.
Yes, and the German Jewish thinker Hannah Arendt was very influenced by Tocqueville, as she wrote her very influential book, The Origins of Totalitarianism, about Nazism and ultimately Stalinism, making an argument about their basic affinity. Can you tell us what the thrust was of Arendt's argument in that book?
Well, the book is really actually divided into three parts, and I focus really on the most famous part, which is called totalitarianism. The first part is on anti-Semitism, the second part is imperialism, but the last part is totalitarianism. And there she makes an extraordinarily powerful and very vivid case that basically the modern world is about the creation and the experience of a profound sense of isolation. Even to the point of what she calls loneliness, which she distinguishes from isolation. It's that Tocquevillian account that everybody lives a very private existence, bowling alone, right? And we lack the confidence and the assuredness of traditional institutions, you know, religion, and local neighborhoods and things like that, and we're just thrown out into the world, into this abyss of anomie. Anomie is a big concept, you know, that develops in the 19th century and that she makes quite a bit of. And out of that experience, that terrible psychic experience of loneliness, we long for not just a strong man, a Hitler or a Stalin, but somebody whose strength and terror is tied to what she calls ideology. That is, and ideology, she says, is a completely fabricated and fictitious world, but it's consistent, and one in which we can have some confidence that our expectations will be fulfilled. It's a world that's not like the real world, where, of course, everything is inconsistent. I mean, just think of our everyday experience. You know, sometimes things work out, sometimes they don't. We have ambivalence, we have conflict, all of that. All of that gets wiped away in the world of ideology. And instead, and she thought Marxism and fascism were two, the profound ideological, or Marxism and racism, were the appeal of those ideas was not that they subjugated, class enemies or racial enemies or anything like that. It's not the content, it's the form of the argument. And it's an argument that has all the predictability and consistency of mathematics, right? 2 + 2 is always 4. You can always count on it. Doesn't matter where you are, doesn't matter what time period you're in, it will always be true. And that's what ideology provides. And the problem is, of course, is that then you have to make the ideology true, right? If you say that the Jews are a pestilence, that are the enemy of the race, they need to become that. And if you say that the Jews are a dying race, they need to die. So he has a kind of predictive capacity that needs to be executed. And that, she says, is what the concentration camps are really, and the Gulag are about. They are laboratories in which ideological truth is established and executed. And the consequence of those laboratories is an awful lot like what Montesquieu described in his account of despotic terror. We become Pavlovian dogs. We are reduced to automatons. And that, for her, is the ultimate catastrophe and nightmare, is that human beings whose singular capacity, she always argues, is our capacity to invent things new, to do things different, right? To change patterns, to establish new patterns. That's what makes us human, is our ability to break with the predictability of natural rhythms. Right, a dog gets up every day and eats and runs and sleeps. There's a predictability there. Humans can break with that. what totalitarianism does in order to produce this consistent ideological universe is it has to destroy that capacity for novelty, that human capacity for creating something new, and therefore it turns people into instruments and automatons that look like that kind of physics of power that I described earlier in Montesquieu.
And yet, interestingly, Hannah Arendt revised her assessment of political fear and the nature of fascism in her book about Adolf Eichmann, who helped oversee the execution of the Holocaust. In 1961, she traveled to Israel to report on the trial of Eichmann for the New Yorker, and the resulting book was Eichmann in Jerusalem, which, in fact, was very controversial. How did her ideas shift in that work more than a decade later?
She looked at Eichmann, and far from seeing the sort of the lonely crowd, right, the isolated individual, the flotsam and jetsam of mass society, what she saw in Eichmann instead was a very different kind of animal. And that is somebody who really just wanted to climb up the ladder of established society. So, of course, the premise of the book is that the premise of the origins of totalitarianism is that established society and institutions had been overthrown by the 19th century, and that what totalitarianism was to try to solve the kind of psychic wound that's created in the absence of traditional institutions. But in Eichmann, those traditional institutions are alive and well. I mean, Anna Arendt was an extraordinarily accomplished and acute social satirist. Almost like a 19th century novelist, a British novelist, or a Viennese kind of satirist like Karl Kraus, who could see that kind of striving parvenu type who really just wanted to get ahead and be accepted in good society. And that's what she saw in Eichmann. So far from being part of the lonely crowd, he's willing to just work his way up the greasy ladder of success. The other thing also, and this is something she was really attacked for, this is the famous argument she makes about the absence of Jewish, not only the absence of Jewish resistance to the Nazis, but she says it's the real the fact is that the leadership of the Jewish councils, the Jewish leadership, were actually accomplices, essentially collaborators, who sent the Jews to their death. And she was attacked, and historically a lot of arguments have not really stood up. But I think what she was trying to get at there, the important point that she's trying to make, and this is, again, very different from her account of total terror, is in the origins of totalitarianism, is that terror requires collaborators. It requires people who are going to, implement, its plans. And it was a return, I think, in ways to Hobbes's original argument. And the premise of that, of course, is that then you need institutions. These people, need to be paid. They need to be promoted. There's a famous quote from Disraeli that I think I use in the book. Where he's talking about the Orient, he says the East is a career. I think it's from Tancred. And, Hannah Arendt is saying that, genocide is a career. And it's a harrowing thought. But if you look at a lot of the reports, what we do now know about the Nazis and their collaborators, I mean, it was an extensive, world of collaboration. Likewise in the Soviet Union and the Stasi in East Germany. These regimes exist not by pulverizing civil society, which is how she described it in the origins, but by insinuating themselves into civil society. And they gain collaborators not by crushing people into Pavlovian dogs, which is, again, the portrait one gets. I mean, she has, in the origins, the closing chapters of the origins of totalitarianism, she basically says, even the people who are at the at the top ranks of a concentration camp, everybody knows that ultimately they themselves are going to be sacrificed to the purity of the ideology. So everybody, is ultimately a victim. And I think what she pulled back from that and realized, Eichmann is not sacrificing himself, and all the people who participate are not sacrificing themselves. They're actually trying to advance themselves this is, and again, I see it as a kind of return to the original Hobbesian argument that fear is a form of self-advance. And I think that's what she came to in the Eichmann book. And, you know, a lot of that got lost in all the noise about the accusations about the Jewish leadership. But if anything, I think that The Origins is a book that allows the Nazis to get much more off the hook, whereas in Eichmann, they're back on the hook. They're not just automatons. They're actually a real agents making choices.
And you're pointing to something which is a theme that runs throughout your book, Fear, the History of a Political Idea, which is that these institutions that are so beloved by liberals of civil society can actually be the mechanisms of repression and of the dissemination of fear. One example that you spend quite a sizable amount of time looking at in the book is the McCarthy era, where we have a notion of that period of time as being kind of the received wisdom is top-down, elites running amok, the rule of law failed, and it's sort of about the demonization of people, and that's about it. But you come at it in a quite a different way, both in terms of the impact of the repression on the public at large and the mechanisms through which that repression took place.
Yeah, I mean, and you've got the argument exactly right. Our whole constitutional system and our whole liberal, you know, democracy is premised upon a series of assumptions about what secures freedom, right? It's a state that is constrained fundamentally by, as you say, the rule of law, by an independent civil society that's very diverse and plural, and by a set of institutions within the state that are fragmented, right? So you have the separation of powers at the national level, you have a federated system with a division between national, state, and local. And, you know, we're all taught this in our civics books, and in the 90s in particular, when I was a graduate student, that argument achieved a kind of tremendous amount of traction in the post-communist world. The assumption was that, you know, the problem with communism and the problem, you know, of totalitarianism is there is no rule of law, there is a unified state system, and there is no independent civil society. And when I looked at McCarthyism, which for me was, you know, one of the key moments in American history, I found that far from there being no rule of law, it was a regime in a time that was riddled with legal proceduralism, and you know, there's, you know, any one of a number of examples that I think I cite in the book. You know, if you look at the way these laws were written, there was very careful attention to trying to identify who the real, you know, targets were. People who were called to testify before congressional committees, which again are, you know, oftentimes depicted as you said, as this kind of Wild West. In fact, you know, there were very elaborate procedures that were very predictable, and that's a very important point to make, is that the people who make these claims about the rule of law, it's the predictability of the rule of law that makes people feel not coerced. Well, these laws were not arbitrary. They were actually quite, you know, careful and predictable, and that was their problem. It was who they were targeting. The role of federalism, you know, that somehow or another that the division of power between the states and the national government is supposed to secure freedom. In my reading of McCarthyism, it actually exacerbated the repression, because you didn't just have HUAC, you didn't just have a House Committee on Un-American Activities. You had something like anywhere from 30 to 40 little HUACs, they were called, including in California, where you are, a very powerful one, that did the same thing that the federal government was doing, it only it was more targeted in, you know, in more local and specific contexts. So you had the reproduction, all the kind of the Smith Act, you know, which was used to such dramatic effect to prosecute the Communist Party, there were little Smith Acts, and so on and so on. So federalism, the separation of powers, actually, I argue, encouraged each competing branch of government to kind of up the ante of coerciveness in all sorts of ways. But I think the most important lesson that I took, the sort of kicker for me, or the take-home message about McCarthyism is, for all our focus on what the government did during the McCarthy years, right, everything from Joe McCarthy himself to the Smith Act to the trials, all these things, the real action, the real reason why McCarthyism so decimated America happened at the level of what we call civil society. It was not at the level of the state. Numbers. I think, you know, even if you're being your most generous or your most sort of latitudinous, you would say maybe close to 200 people ended up in jail for political reasons during the McCarthy era, which if you compare it to other tyrannical, you know, repressive regimes, that's it's peanuts, it's nothing. And so people look at that and they say, well, you know, it doesn't seem so bad. But if you look at the workforce, you find, and there's lots of estimates, but I've seen anywhere as high as 40% of the American workforce was subject to a political surveillance regime where they would be investigated for their beliefs and fired or demoted if they were found to be somehow or another disloyal. And disloyal was a category that was, you know, thrown around with great aplomb. It could mean anything from supporting civil rights, if you're in the South, because of course the only people who supported civil rights were communists, to supporting peace, to, you know, anything like that. And at that quotidian level of the workplace, you saw just a tremendous regime of an apparatus of coercion and repressive fear. And ultimately, if you look at other tyrannical regimes, which was the sort of next step in the implication of the argument, you'll find, you know, similar things. Obviously, in the Soviet Union, Nazi Germany, the state is much, much more active, but there is a tremendous role. I mean, if you look at things like East Germany in the 80s and in the 70s, you know, the Stasi really works through the whole sort of network of collaborators, you know, who are all private actors. And, you know, in the workplace, in families and things like that. So, you know, that civil society, far from being, as I said, far from being pulverized and crushed, the more independent in a way that it is and the more plural it is, the more opportunities there are for this sort of coercion to take its effect.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and my guest is Corey Robin, author of Fear, The History of a Political Idea. His forthcoming book is The Reactionary Mind. Well, in fact, your book does really take apart this notion, and as you say, it's been very, very fashionable over the last couple decades of civil society being the realm of democracy or being this bulwark for good. And one of the constituent parts, as you've alluded to, of civil society is private enterprise, the workplace. And you take a turn in the book, which might surprise some people, to argue that, in fact, one of the main arenas for political fear is, in fact, the workplace.
Yeah, and I mean, I think there's a couple of ways to think about that. I mean, one we've already discussed is that the workplace oftentimes is the adjutant of the state. And in the United States in particular, there's a very powerful reason for why that's the case. For better or for worse, we do have a constitution which puts constraints upon what the state can do, right? The state can't prescribe an official state religion, can't abridge freedom of speech, so on and so forth. However, and people oftentimes don't know this, and any union organizer will tell you, you find this with workers all the time, they don't know that the First Amendment doesn't apply to the workplace. You don't have freedom of speech at work. Any employer can penalize you for exercising your First Amendment rights with absolute impunity. And as we saw during the McCarthy era, the state is almost has an incentive, because of the legal constraints that are put upon it by the Constitution, to outsource the coerciveness to the private sector, to do the work that the state cannot do for one way, for one reason or another. So that's one dimension of the role of the workplace and political fear. It's an outsourced institution to do that which the state cannot, for one reason or another, do. But I think there's a second dimension, which in recent years I've really begun to grapple with much, much more, which is that quite apart from whether or not the workplace is performing any service on behalf of the state, it is a regime of tremendous coercion in and of itself. It is, as I've already said, you know, many of the kinds of restrictions we have put on the state to create some kind of semblance of a liberal democracy do not exist in the workplace. And I have some fairly dramatic examples, but, of people being denied the right to urinate, to go to the bathroom when they have to pee on the job, purely legally. You can be told, you know, you can't pee. You can be told you have to go pee for a drug test. You can be told what to wear. You can be told what to say. You can be told what not to say. Employers have a power over their workers that if the state ever exercised that, we would blanch. And yet, you know, the workplace is this kind of unlicensed regime of power and domination that even today, exists, and in fact, I would argue has been getting more and more, has been getting worse. So I think, I point toward the end of the book that, you know, for all the talk about, and when I said this at the time, this was perceived to be very controversial. I think today it's probably much less controversial, but, you know, at the time everybody was, you know, terrified of bin Laden, Al-Qaeda, and this, that, and the other, and, you know, if you actually looked at the real day-to-day experience of people, who are they most afraid of? It's their supervisors at work, because those are the people who have tremendous power. I mean, have real power over them. And as I said, when I said that, you know, at the time, that was a fairly heterodox, controversial thing to say. You know, we're still in the wake of 9/11. But I think now, as we're seeing with this kind of financial economic meltdown, you know, you have two problems. I mean, one is people just don't have work at all. But in conditions where you have high unemployment, everybody is just thankful to have a job, and they're, you know, all the more inclined to toe the line of the boss because, God forbid, you should get fired. You know, what are you going to fall back on? So I think the role of the workplace, I mean, we have this mythology that, you know, the American dream is, you know, work hard, right? It's always work hard. Work is the key to emancipation. And if you actually look at both the reality and also, I think, our culture, I mean, there's certain sort of sub rosa markers in our culture that suggests we know that it's not. So, for instance, I look at the autobiography of Benjamin Franklin, who, you know, the original Horatio Alger, hard worker and all the rest of it. Well, Benjamin Franklin became Benjamin Franklin because he fled Boston. And the reason he fled Boston, where he grew up, was because he was working for his older brother, who was a tyrant. And so he left that job, but he knew he'd be blacklisted, so he had to get out, and he took off. And not long after, he ends up in Philadelphia, and he becomes Ben Franklin. So my argument is Ben Franklin became Ben Franklin not through hard work, but through fleeing hard work. One of my favorite movies of all time, The Apartment with Jack Lemmon and Shirley MacLaine. What is that movie really about? It's about the kind of domination one experiences at the work, in work, where you're really turned into, you're really kind of pressed down on quite hard. And I think, you know, we have, you know, films like 9 to 5, Working Girl. You know, there's a real, if you read these films carefully and this literature, you see that, you know, we know this somewhere, that these are regimes of tremendous domination and coercion. And yet we have a mythology, though, that tells us otherwise.
Political fear, then, the thread that sort of runs throughout, which we really haven't touched on directly, is that it is in opposition to something. There is this notion, an ambivalence at best, about the masses in the different thinkers that you've discussed and discuss in the book, Fear, and at worst, a real horror of mass social mobilization in some way. And so the workplace may be one arena in which that is held in check. Which leads me to ask you, what is the relationship between, more broadly, revolution and counter-revolution, or social mobilization and the repression of social mobilization, that seems to be so central to the argument that you've been making?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's an excellent question. I think when we talk about political fear, we have a tendency, insofar as we do talk about it, to think about it as either self and other, or the or a nation and its enemies. Right? The Americans are afraid of the Russians. Americans are afraid of Al Qaeda. Muslims in the Middle East are afraid of the West. It's these very organized blocks that are afraid of each other. And it's a kind of a, Carl Schmitt called this the friend-enemy distinction, which has become a very fashionable term in political theory and political science. And the picture there is kind of two contending armies on a plane who are relatively equal, and but are terrorized of each other. And Schmitt, in his political theory, thought that this was the kind of existential condition of our own being, was that, you know, we become who we are as a polity by virtue of our fear of an other, and that's the common way, and there's a certain truth to that. I mean, I don't deny it for one second, but I think, and what my book is really trying to get us to look at, is not to look at organized groups contending as equals on a plane, which is a very horizontal view of the world, but of a more vertical view of the world, in which people with power are contending constantly with people without power, or people with less power, people that they are ruling over, and that the theorists that I'm looking at, with the exception, you know, certainly up through Montesquieu, really understood that. They understood that fear was a tool of governance, a means of domination of people on top over the people on bottom. And I should also say, I mean, I don't talk about this as much, but, you know, people on bottom, you know, it's not just that the people on the bottom are scared of the people on top. The people on top are terrified of the people on the bottom. And for good reason, because, you know, you dominate people for so long, you're terrorized that, you know, one day they're going to rise up and slit your throat. And that's the story of American slavery and its aftermath in a nutshell. So the fears that I look at are really, you know, what sociologists used to call vertical fears, because they're premised upon hierarchies of power. And the sort of larger theory that comes out of that is that, and these are words that are so unfashionable today, but, you know, certainly in Berkeley as not long ago as I would say the 80s, and in other places maybe a little bit earlier, the forces of revolution and counter-revolution are really these fundamental forces that have shaped modern politics, going back to Hobbes. This sort of points in my new book that's coming out, The Reactionary Mind. I'm through this work on political fear, I was really led to uncover this world that, you know, we used to know about and talk about, but I think, you know, for a variety of reasons, one of which is the collapse of communism, the collapse of the left, the rise of the right, we've lost touch with that. It's ironic, though, because the one place where you will find an understanding of that is on the right. But on the left, it's been dissipated by all kinds of, you know, fancy theories and other forces. So and fear is really, I guess, through fear I came to see that world, because that's the world that these political theorists, beginning with Hobbes, really understood. You know, it is a world where, as John Stuart Mill called it, there was the party of movement, which is the left, the party of revolution, and the party of order, which is the right. I think those aren't the best ways of describing them, for reasons that we won't get into here, but that is the world that I'm trying to kind of, not to bring the world back into existence, it never went into a way, but that's the kind of language that I'm trying to bring back into our vocabulary, because I think it's the only, or it's at least a critical language to making sense of the world we still inhabit.
Corey, it's been a pleasure having you on.
Thanks very much. I really enjoyed it.
I've been speaking with Corey Robin, author of Fear, The History of a Political Idea, published by Oxford University Press. You can find a link to that book on our website, againstthegrain.org. He teaches political science at Brooklyn College and the CUNY Graduate Center, and his forthcoming book is The Reactionary Mind, Conservatism from Edmund Burke to Sarah Palin, which will be published by Oxford this fall. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is co-produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please check us out on the web at againstthegrain.org, where you can find on-demand and downloadable audio, and it's the most reliable way to sign up for our podcast. You can also call us at 510-848-6767, extension 670, or visit us on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio. I'd like to thank our engineer today, Erica Bridgman.